Accession number 27347, Reel 11.
And Reel 11.
Well, having been told she's all yours, best of luck, you won't need it, off I went. I took terrific care about weaving on the taxiing out, and I went down as far downwind as I could to give me the longest possible run. And then I turned a crosswind and parked, ran my engine up to clear the plugs, went through all the things I'd been taught, and at the end of it I thought, God, I hope I haven't forgotten anything. And I was rubbernecking all the time, watching other people coming in to land and trying to judge when was the moment to turn in. And then eventually deciding that the time was right. There was a big enough gap. The man with the green oldest lamp gave me a green. I turned into wind and thought, this is it. Opened up the throttle, and she immediately started to bounce. She was so light without the instructor. This was the thing that nobody had warned me about it, but I could kick myself for not thinking about it. She was light, she was responsive, and she was mine. I suppose the first time somebody got on a horse, they felt much the same as I did then. Bumpity bump, it was a grass field, and then all the vibration, all the roughness disappeared. I was airborne on my own. This was flying. The blur of the blades of grass had disappeared. It became just a green patch, and I was climbing. And of course, knowing that I had to concentrate on my airspeed, not to get into a stall, to make sure that I wasn't converging with anybody else, that I was gaining height, I was going in the right direction. A feeling of elation, and yet having to throw a lot of cold water on myself to retain my objectivity. I didn't want to be too carried away with the excitement of it, and there was excitement with it, just as there is for the boy who gets on a motorbike for the first time and opens up the throttle. Looking out was my biggest concentration, because to fly in front of another pupil who had an instructor with him was a sure way of being handed your cards when you got down. You'd have a furious instructor. I never had it, but there were people who had a furious instructor pounding on their tiger moth when they got down. Crosswind, right height, throttle back a bit, hold your height, look around you. You're just over that farmhouse, it's about time you started to turn downwind. You're at 1,000 feet. You don't want to be too high, otherwise you'd come in over the boundary and you'd have to go around again, which you don't want to do because everybody's watching, hoping you're going to drop a clanger. Knowing that there was about a 1/3 wastage, if a third of the people, a third of your course failed, you were a cert to get through, So you're always hoping that other people would fail, not you. The point of turning a crosswind was vital, because crosswind if you had a wind that was pretty strong, you'd be crabbing strongly, and this could affect your judgment of the instant to turn in. When to start reducing power depended largely on the wind speed. If the wind was very high, you had to be almost over your landing boundary, because as you reduced height, you wouldn't have much forward travel. If the wind was light, you had a lot of forward travel, so you'd have to turn in much further away from the field. Judging that was a difficulty, because the wind speed may have changed between the time you were with your instructor for the last time and the time you were doing it on your own. So there was quite a bit of mental tussle as you were going crosswind. Had you turned too early, too late? It was always better to have turned too early and be too high, because you could sideslip some height off just by putting on rudder and cutting your engine and coming down like that, crabbing. You could sideslip off the height. But the important thing was not to come down on somebody who was making an approach camouflaged by the background of the fields and so on. It was easy to miss seeing somebody lower than yourself. It was always better to try and be lower than the other people. So it was a difficult balance of decision. Anyway, I made the right one, and I made a good glide approach and landing. I went over the boundary fence with a good clearance, the height of a house, I suppose, with all the field stretching in front of me. And I made the most perfect landing I've ever made, I think. Three-point landing, and I'm down. And what a feeling of pride that I'd done it. And I taxied in to the crew hut and nonchalantly undid all the straps and so on, stopped the engine, and got out as if I'd been doing it all my life, you know. And my instructor was there to greet me and say, he said, "That was very nice. Why don't you always do it like that?" But it could have been, what a bloody awful mess you made of that. And that did happen to a lot of boys, because on the first solo, nerves do come into it, and judgment is impaired by a state of nerves. I was lucky, and there we are. I was glad to be down.
Because it must be a strange feeling to suddenly step into that aircraft and just be yourself there.
Yes.
Not only the physical effects on the aircraft, but actually not having the console or anything, the instructors with you.
Yes. Lord and master of all your survey. I think that's the way to describe it.
So your instructor would observe you from the ground.
Oh, yes.
You're making your circuit.
And he'd make any comments that he disapproved of.
Now, obviously you soloed and it was a good solo. Would people, if they made a mess of it, would they be made to do another solo?
No. They'd either be struck off the list there and then, or they'd be taken up by their instructor, given 2 or 3 hours repetition, and then the chief flying instructor would take them to see if they were fit for another solo. A failed solo was a bad omen. The chances of recovering the situation and going solo a second time after a chief flying instructor's test, the chances were pretty grim. Usually it was a case of, after your first solo, go up for another flight with your instructor as soon as possible. I'm trying to remember if I did one quickly. We were having an awful lot of bad weather at the time. The first flight after my first solo, taking off into wind, approach and landing, engine assisted approach and landing, instrument flying and instruments. He put the hood over me.
That quickly after the first solo?
Yes, the first flight after the first solo, instrument flying.
So how did that work with the hood?
You know, I don't remember. I think it was something that the instructor released by pulling on a wire that released a catch, and the hood came back over the top. I don't remember how it was done, but there it is, instrument flying.
So can you explain the processes of what you had to do instrument flying under that hood?
Well, it was something that we'd done on the Link trainer. The Link trainer had the instruments that we had. It had a throttle. It had bumpy air and smooth air. The first thing to do was keep it straight and level on instruments. Now, we'd had practice under the Link trainer hood, where you keep your artificial horizon constant in spite of bumps. They'd regulate bumps so that your nose came up and went down, so that you had to make corrections. They'd put on conditions where you would yaw and you had to bring it back on your compass. You had to keep your height without gaining on the altimeter or losing on the altimeter. And once he was convinced that you could hold it on a straight and level, you'd do a turn. He'd say turn 90 degrees left or turn 90 degrees right. They were rough and they didn't understand port and starboard. And then after doing turns, it'd be a case of climb up to 3,000 feet or descend to 1,500 feet, and then level out, and then do me a turn to port through 90 degrees.
Initially, how easy is it to trust just your instruments?
you can't do anything else but trust their instruments. If you trust the seat of your pants, you'll end up in a spin. That's the first lesson on the link trainer, I think. Trust your instruments. Instruments know and you don't. You've got to bow to the instruments. You've got to give them, let them take charge.
And can you just describe for me the link trainer, what it looked like? People who've never seen one.
It looked like a coffin with two stub wings, with a hood over the middle of the coffin, and you climbed into it, and they battened down the hood. There was no chance of peeping whatsoever. And it made funny noises and did funny things, always taking you unexpected, because that was the whole secret of the link train, to see how fast you responded, how fast you could correct something that went wrong. All controlled by the bloke sitting at the desk. He could throw you into a spin, see if you can recover from that one. He could make you wander off course. He could make you lose height. He could make you gain height. He could cut your engine. It was a wonderful piece of equipment. Saved an awful lot of lives. It taught us, as we said just now, don't trust the seat of your pants. The seat of your pants is fallible. The instruments, sometimes you'll have an instrument failure, and in fact, they did cancel out some of the instruments on occasion to see how you'd respond. You'd suddenly see the altimeter go joing like that. Yes, you didn't always make the right decision. Calamity.
So you did your first instrument training immediately after soloing. What other types of flying training were you involved in after soloing? Was there a development in what you've been doing?
A lot of low flying. A lot of forced landings, a lot of navigational exercises. They gave us a map and said, go down to Birmingham and report in at the control tower and get them to stamp and sign your logbook with the time you arrived there, and what sort of a job you made of your landing and your taxiing round. Were you a menace to anybody else on the airfield? So yes, we did quite a lot of navigational exercises.
With those kind of cross-country exercises, how would you navigate? Obviously you have your map, but would you have to use points on the land?
Yes, we would draw on the map a straight line joining the two, and we'd try and follow that. We'd be given the wind speed and direction, and following our navigation instruction, we had to decide what course we had to fly to keep to that track. And then once you were on the track, of course you were map reading. And it's amazing how many people got lost in spite of having the map and starting off from one place and having a line that crossed railways, rivers, roads, the lot, they couldn't relate the two. I'm fortunate in that when I'm driving from A to B, I have a sense of where north and south is the whole time, and I put this down to the training that I had then, because I'd never driven a car. And then, of course, landing at a new airfield, especially one where the other half of our flying course were training, and they used to send them to our airfield as well, so that any boo-boo that you've committed held you up to the ridicule of your friends. But it was a nice way of reuniting with your friends that you'd trained with as far as St. Vincent, and you were now both flying and swapping stories of who'd failed, and it was a lovely gesture to send us back to Elmden to reunite us with our old friends. And they let us have a couple of hours there before we flew back.
And when you are flying, how do you read your map? Where is your map?
Your map is generally wrapped around the fin and rudder if you're not careful. The first time you lose a map, you vow that you'll never be caught out again, because it's such a feeling of helplessness. Although, if you've been following your map, you know where that railway was running from and to that you passed. Let's turn round and go back to it and then follow the railway. Or it's not so easy to follow a road. A canal is lovely. And you'd go back to the last remembered point and pick it up from there if once you lost your map, but you'd swear never to lose it again.
So when you're reading your map, because obviously maps fall out,
yes,
how do you actually do that while you're flying the aircraft?
You're very, very careful with it. That's all I can say is you're very careful with it. You don't take any risks with it. You don't just put it down on your knee. You unzip and push it in and zip up again rather than put it down. Turning from one page to another is the difficult thing. And with a quarter of an inch to a mile, which was our scale with aerial maps in those days, an 80-mile journey is 20 inches. It's gone over a crease, gone over a fold. So you have to unfold your map. And the thing to do is to refold it before you take off. Anticipation was one of the most important things in becoming a pilot. Thinking about what can happen. What will I do if it does happen? What will I do if it doesn't happen? Anticipation and being prepared for the worst thing that can happen. They say that there are old pilots and bold pilots, but there are very few old, bold pilots. And you have to make up your mind that you're not going to be one of them. I'm going to grow old by watching what I'm doing all the time and what I'm going to do and what I have done.
Speaking slightly of that, you also mentioned that you were doing low flying. Now,
yes.
What's the sensation of low flying?
Exhilarating. It was always a temptation. But with the knowledge that you were immediately dismissed from the flying course if you did it without authorization. Very few people practiced it until later on in the course. For instance, I'm looking ahead a while now at Kingston, Ontario. On our first night solo in a Harvard, it was routine that if you were not a chicken, you flew under the International Bridge at Gananoque at night when they couldn't read your identification letters. If you do it during the day, you've had it, you're back to England. But you can do it at night, and if you don't do it, you're chicken.
While you were doing it in England, though, would there be an area that you would have to practice North London?
Yes. Generally, low concentration of inhabitation. Farms fairly well apart. There were times of the year when we were not allowed to do it. For instance, lambing season, when the cows were out to graze in the milking season, outdoor milking season, we'd have a place that was perhaps along an estuary where there were no cattle. The low-flying area was marked pretty clearly on our maps, but it did vary according to the season, and it varied also to get us used to different types of terrain. For instance, they would choose a low-flying area which had a string of high-tension wires across it to make sure that we gave them plenty of clearance. And that if we were going to fly under them, to do it near to a pylon, not in the middle.
Pylons being one obstacle, were there any other obstacles to be aware of while you were low flying?
Oh, yes, your girlfriend's chimney. Or your girlfriend's house. It was pretty well fatal, because if you beat up low flying somewhere that you knew, the neighbours would also know who it was, because word got around, oh, that's Jane's boyfriend, and a complaint on the telephone to the airfield was almost certain to follow. People didn't like low-flying aircraft. I suppose it was because of fright for children as much as anything, or fright for livestock. But people didn't like low flyers, but except the low flyers themselves.
You also mentioned forced landings. Did you actually practice a forced landing?
Yes. We practiced actually landing, and then this was, of course, by arrangement with a farmer. First of all, it was at a satellite airfield, where we would land, a grass airfield usually, without a runway, so that you had to determine the wind direction and land into wind. And part of that area would have obstructions of some kind, either trees, fences, ditches, or even a railway line, so that you had to choose whereabouts in the landing area you were going to go according to the wind direction.
And had you become more adept at sort of spotting these airfields as the course had gone on?
Oh, certainly. The first time you do it, you think to yourself, have I missed anything? Have I missed a telephone wire going across the field at 25 feet up? is it one of these fields that has undulations in from medieval farming? Is the grass freshly mown and lying in swathes that'll wrap round your wheels, or is it a long time since it was mown, so that the grass is so long that it'll give such a resistance to your motion that you'll tip over and dig your nose in? Is the ground boggy? There are all sorts of things that you had to judge.